Buddhist Summer School, Monday afternoon, 27th August 1984. Venerable sirs and venerable lady and friends. The discipline which culminates in the supreme enlightenment, the Samma Sambodhi, releases dormant faculties of the mind in the Holy One. First, we must note that the unskilled thought, speech, and action of the unenlightened worldly state flourishes no more. The psychical life of the worldly state, the thoughts and feelings, the desires, ambitions and moods, the pleasure drives, follies and misdirected efforts, all of which spring out of the self-oriented consciousness through the influence of the ductless glands and the general bodily state and external circumstances. This psychical life of the worldly state has come to its end and dried up like a stream in the desert. Or, to use the Buddha's excellent phrase, cut down to the roots, made like a palm tree stump. He uses that phrase over and over again. And what has been made like a palm tree stump? Ignorance, the passion for future becoming, craving, the five fetters, the sense of separate selfhood, the conceit, and conceit means fanciful notion, it's the old meaning. The conceit, I am. This comes in the Majjhima, in the Alagaddupama Sutta, in the Mahasachakka Sutta, and also in the Brahma Nimantanika Sutta. Anyone looking for the vijnana, the discriminative consciousness of a Tathagata, can never find it. Why not? The Buddha affirms, I, monks, say here and now that a Tathagata is untraceable. What then has happened to the vijnana of Siddhartha Gautama? It has been transmuted into the vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato pabham. Consciousness, characterless, endless, everywhere shining. It is obvious that this therefore does not refer to something which characterizes just a separate individual. If it did, it wouldn't be shining everywhere. Vijnana knows by looking from a distance at the observed object. There is a separation between self and not self. Vijnana functions in the context of the finite and temporal, the sphere of mortality. Vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato pabham. Does not obtain knowledge by looking as an observing subject at an observed object. It knows by being in mind and consciousness that which is known. It is the ultimate unity, the state of supreme sinlessness. There is no separation between self and not self. except of course that the existential being, the bodily person, is separate from other bodily persons. But in mind and consciousness, he is totally in unison with all that is all creatures. There is, for the context of this pure mind and consciousness, is the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. In that transcendent context, where there is no separation, no otherness, there is no separate person who can find any other. The wholeness is the one perfect, unbroken holiness. Thus, we may begin to understand why the Tathagata is untraceable. And we can also understand why the idea of a personal creator God as a separate being is inadequate, misleading, and unacceptable. Those who find the concept of a personal God as a separate being acceptable are unable to see that all the qualities ascribed to this God are only a projection out of their own brains of what they would like their God to be, namely themselves apotheosized. If you look at the descriptions of a personal God in all the scriptures of the world, you will see that those descriptions are merely projections of oneself and one's own qualities. And they are remarkably significant as indicators of personal likes and dislikes and all the rest of it. And as we all know, in Africa, God is a very, very dark in complexion. In England, he's an Englishman, and so on and so on. The personal God idea has, however, had its value, because it is an expression of an ideal of what the man would like to be. It is an expression of his ideal. He aspires to that in a dim sort of way. And the idea is still helpful for millions of people as a pedagogos and a propaideutic. Pedagogos in Greece, you know, was the man who accompanied the schoolboy to school. And from that we got our word pedagogue afterwards. And a propaideutic is a temporary preliminary learning which is necessary before you proceed to the next advanced stage. So, let us observe Sri Krishna's compassionate teaching when he tells Arjuna, "Let not the wise unsettle the mind of the ignorant attached to action." And again, he says, "The man of perfect knowledge should not unsettle the foolish whose knowledge is imperfect." This comes in the third discourse of the Bhagavad Gita. As a man progresses on his path, I emphasize the his, because each and every person, being unique, has his own unique individual path. That is through his own being, actually. He becomes increasingly sensitive to his environment. Ordinarily, self-consciousness is strongly confined to oneself. Whoever watches his thought process diligently will discover that most of it revolves endlessly round the personal pronoun first person singular. I wish, I want, I think, I believe, I ought or I ought not to, etc. The whole process starts with I and ends up with me or with I will win or get. That will be profitable or useful to me. I will make £1,000,000 or get a knighthood, etc., etc. Ordinarily, the worldling is blind to the world's problems, sorrows, dangers, and follies. Most people are quite ignorant of the purposes of their existence. Some have a vague awareness of right purpose, but have no clue to the way to fulfill it. Many people have a sense of duty, but it is confined to worldliness. Rarely is it a lucid sense of dharma. Gradually, the hard crust of isolativeness and separativeness softens and dissolves. Then the man begins to awake to an inclusive consciousness. It is not just a case of other persons being related to himself of necessity because of family membership or business or civil responsibility. That kind of acceptance is due to the imposition of an idea. He or she is one of us because he belongs to the same team or club or firm or union. Trade unions. The inclusive consciousness is a consciousness in terms of us, not merely of you and me. It's an us consciousness which embraces all humanity, ultimately. The separate you and me have become a single I or we. The separateness of the other has disappeared, and you are actually conscious unitarily. This unitarily whole consciousness is the source of transcendent love, of the love that maketh wise, that healeth all ills. This is, of course, the culminating point. There are several stages in between. In the worldly state, the peaks can be touched by parental love, by marital love, by the love the true teacher has for his fellow students, by the true friend. Speaking to the Venerable Chunda the Great, on one occasion, this occurs in the Salleka Sutta, and to a group of monks on another occasion, which occurs in the Dveda Vittaka Sutta, the Buddha said, "Whatever is to be done from compassion by a teacher, seeking the welfare of his disciples, that has been done by me for you out of compassion." Meditate, monks, do not be slothful, be not remorseful later. This is our instruction to you. Because of the purity of the psyche and the consequent unobstructed functioning of pure mind, the Arahant can exercise mental powers hitherto not fully awakened. The Buddha himself declares, 1. Thus, with the mind composed, quite purified, quite clarified, without blemish, without defilement, grown soft and workable, fixed, immovable, I directed my mind to the knowledge and recollection of former habitations. 2. Then, with the mind composed, I directed my mind to the knowledge of the passing hence and arising of beings. With the purified deva vision, clairvoyance, surpassing that of men, I see beings as they pass hence or come to be. I comprehend that beings are mean, comely, excellent, ugly, well-going or ill-going, according to the consequences of their deeds, good or bad, in thought and speech and action. After dying, the good uprise in a heaven world, the bad go to hell. This was the second knowledge. It occurs in several suttas, such as the Bhaya Bhairava Sutta. 3. The Lord knows intuitively by mind the minds of others, whether or not a person's mind is full of attachment, aversion, confusion, contracted, distracted, become great, composed, freed. This occurs in the Mahasihanada Sutta. 4. Besides being clairvoyant, he is clairaudient. For with purified deva hearing, he can hear deva-like sounds as well as human sounds, and also the conversation of people at a distance. This occurs in the Mahavachagutta and the Magandhya Suttas. Rather problematical, isn't it, for a person who has any sort of conscience of what he has done to approach a perfected holy one. He can hear all he says, if he wants to, that is. But I don't suppose they ever really intruded upon anybody's privacy. 5. He has various psychic powers. Being one, he can become manifold and back again into one. From being visible, he can make himself invisible and again become visible. He goes unhindered through a wall or a rampart or a mountain as if through air. He plunges into the ground and shoots up again as if in water. He walks upon water as if on ground. He goes through air like a bird. Even the sun and the moon he rubs and strokes with his hand. This occurs in the Mahasihanada Sutta. But I want to read you a passage from the Digha Nikaya in connection with this. It occurs in the Sampasadaniya Sutanta. Sariputta is talking to the Buddha, and he's speaking in praise of the Buddha. And the Buddha pulls his leg a little bit and says, "Oh, you're speaking very wonderfully. What do you mean by it?" And so forth. And then Sariputta gives this long discourse retailing all the excellences of the Buddha. This is what he says: "Moreover, Lord, unsurpassable is the way in which the Exalted One teaches the norm concerning modes of supernormal power. There are two modes: supernormal power, which is concomitant with the mental intoxicants and worldly aims. This is called ignoble power. Next, supernormal power which is not so concomitant. This is called noble power. And then he details what is the ignoble power. What I have just read out to you is all called the ignoble power because it is concomitant with the mental intoxicants and with worldly aims. And as regards the noble power, when a bhikkhu, if he so desire, remain unconscious of disgust, aversion, in the midst of what is disgusting, or conscious of disgust in what is not disgusting, or unconscious of disgust amid what is both disgusting and the opposite, or conscious of disgust amid what is both disgusting and the opposite, or avoiding both that which is disgusting and the opposite, should remain indifferent to them as such, mindful and understanding. It's a little confusing when one reads this out, but if you care to, it's in the third, of course in this edition it is in the fourth volume of the Digha Nikaya, pages 106 and 107. The whole sutta actually is most well worthwhile reading. Studying, I should say. As in the case of the founders of other religions, the Buddha is credited with many psychic wonders. We call them miracles. The arahants also possess these powers. There is a short account by Moggallana, the close friend of Sariputta, in the Maharatajanaya Sutta, about the venerable Sanjiva, who could easily attain the supreme meditative stage, namely the cessation, the stopping of perception and feeling. On one such occasion, as he was sitting at the root of a tree, some cowherds, goatherds, yeoman farmers, and travellers saw him. It occurred to them, "It is wonderful, it is marvellous, that this recluse is just sitting dead. Come, we will cremate him." They heaped grass and sticks, lit the fire and departed. Towards the end of that night, the venerable Sanjiva emerged out of that attainment of cessation, shook his robes, dressed, took his bowl and entered a village for alms food. When those men who had lit the fire saw him walking for alms food, it occurred to them, "It is wonderful. It is marvelous that this recluse who was sitting dead has come back to life." We in the modern world would dismiss this account as a slightly tall story, as typical of Indian imagination at work, which admittedly could easily surpass Baron Munchausen's wildest frights. But we in the modern world are not quite aware of what changes in bodily reactions to external forces can take place, and what powers and faculties hitherto unknown may become operative when the Holy One's consciousness functions in the transcendent context of the infinite eternal. What appears as factual to us in our finite temporal consciousness may be negated in a transcendent consciousness. Fire may not burn us. Tempest, flood, or earthquake may not kill us. At present, I do not know. We do not know. But when we are changed in a twinkling, what then? Let us wait and see to what we evolve in another 40,000 years. Psychic powers come naturally to some exceptionally constituted people. They can also be deliberately developed. On the whole, it is wise not to strive to develop them. You can easily let loose the devil's brood trying to develop psychic powers. I have come across personally some people of whom one cannot speak now. If you are naturally gifted with them, use them judiciously. There came a time when the Buddha expressly forbade his disciples to display them. Such display, except when a situation necessitates their exercise, feeds vanity and egoism in the one who uses them, and is of no real value to him who witnesses them. Nevertheless, in a long discourse with the wanderer Sakul Udayin in the wanderer's park near Rajagaha, the Buddha gives him many reasons why his own disciples revere, esteem, respect, and honor him and live in dependence upon him. One of the reasons runs as follows. Udayin, a course has been pointed out by me for disciples, practicing which disciples of mine experience the various forms of psychic power. And he mentions the ignoble ones. Having been one, they become manifold. Having been manifold, they become one. Manifest or invisible, they go unhindered through a wall or rampart or mountain as if through air. They plunge into the ground and come up again as if in water. Sitting cross-legged, they travel through the air like a bird on the wing. With their hands, they rub and stroke the sun and the moon. Completely beats me. And even as far as the Brahma world, they have power with the body. This comes in the Mahasakuludayin Sutta, volume 2 of the Majjhima. What precisely do such statements mean? I do not know. It is hardly possible, at least for me, to take them literally. In any case, what is the use of plunging into the ground and popping up again like a cork in water? One can see that flying through the air like a bird may have some good points. No fares to be paid. Swift transport. And probably some lovely scenery on the way. But these statements about psychic powers are supposed to be the words of the Enlightened One. And the Exalted One expressly laid down. You'll find this in the third volume of the Diga, in the Pasadika Sutta, that the Arahant is incapable of deliberately telling lies. So we may deduce that the Buddha's wording of the psychic powers has some hidden meaning, which I at least do not know. Perhaps someone who knows can enlighten you, but I don't know. Psychic sensitivities are dormant in human beings. We all experience their hidden functioning in what we call our instinctive likes and dislikes and feelings about a person or about an atmosphere in a place or a gathering or about some imminent happening. If the psychic sensitivity develops rightly, we can use it consciously, as for instance, in what we call spiritual healing. The miracles performed by the Holy Ones are outstanding expressions of psycho-spiritual powers. for good. In the very distant past, magical religious rituals were in vogue. The skilled and effective celebrant of the ritual was regarded as a magician and revered as a magus. We get our word magi, maga, the Maga Brotherhood of Iran, the Zarathustrian group, from that magus. From about the 5th millennium BC, the priests who were adepts of the magical rituals, like the shamans in the Asian steppe lands, were supposed to be filled with the spirit, inspired by the god who was worshipped. They were the mediums through whom the invoked divine magic was supposed to function. Now, of all the founders of the religions, Zarathustra was the only one who was not only a prophet, but also a priest, a professional priest, a reciter of the holy spells, which were words of powers. He himself affirms in his gathas that he is the Ratu, that means the prophet, the reciter and preacher of the word of power, the mantra. Since, through living the holy life of virtue, his consciousness had blossomed into the holistic state of unitarily whole consciousness, he rejected the old host of the many gods of the Indo-Iranians and replaced them by a single supreme god, Ahura Mazda, the very first purely spiritual and ethical conception of the divinity. It's one of the outstanding features of the Zarathustrian conception of God. I don't think that in any of the other monotheisms you will find a purely spiritual and ethical conception. And there is evidence in his gathas that he had realized union with his God. He declares, "When I beheld thee in my very eyes, then I realized thee in my mind, O Mazda, as the first and also the last of all eternity, as the father of the good mind, the pure mind, as the true creator of virtue, as Lord of all actions of man." Then in another one of his gathas he says, "Now in truth I have beheld him clearly in my mind's eye." Note very carefully, he always says, "in my mind's eye." Knowing through virtue of the good spirit in word and deed, I can now see Mazda Ahura himself. "At the time when thou didst command me, go to virtue in fullness of knowledge, thou hadst not revealed to me things unheard of, but thou didst reveal them when, to dispel all darkness before me, divine obedience accompanied by the blessing of divine light arose within me." Remember that obedience means, in the first instance, listening. Ob and audire, to hear. That's its derivation. So you listen. You listen to the still small voice. But you have so to live live the virtuous life that still small voice can speak and you can hear it. And then there is obedience. "Then did I realize thee as the most bountiful one when the good mind encircled me completely." Notice the emphasis on mind. This found its final culmination with the Buddha and his teachings. But it started quite over 1,000 years before the day of the Buddha. He declared to me, that is Ahuramazda, the good mind declared to me that silent meditation is the best for attaining spiritual enlightenment. Correspondingly, on the other side of the mighty mountains, the Rigvedic Indian cousins of the Zarathustrian Iranians made their affirmation of their realization of unitary wholeness. This comes in the first book of the Rig Veda, hymn 164, verse 46. They call him Indra, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, and he is heavenly, nobly winged Garutman. To what is one, sages give many a title. They call it Agni, Yama, Matharishvan. Note well, these names are but titles of the One. If one takes a verse like that and really meditates on it and gets the essence out of it, one will recognize that these old sages of the Rig Veda were people who had realized that unitarily whole consciousness. And it found its supreme culmination in their promulgation of the doctrine of Brahman and Atma as an identity. As the centuries passed, the perfected holy ones of India, the Upanishadic teachers, realized the culminating point of the evolution of consciousness, which they termed Brahman and Atma, and afterwards affirmed that these two were an identity. It was left to Gautama the Buddha to give the broad hint of the nature of the transcendent context of the realization in samadhi of transcendence itself.